Okay, so let's unpack this. Welcome to a brand new deep dive. We are thrilled to have you with us today because we're going on a journey into one of the most eccentric, brilliant, and honestly frustrating minds of the entire 20th century.
Extremely frustrating,
right?
But absolutely fascinating.
Right. We're digging into the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein, and we're doing this through the lens of a really great lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes. So the mission for our deep dive today is to explore a truly mind-bending premise. I want you to think about all the massive, seemingly unsolvable problems in the world.
The big ones.
Yeah. The deep philosophical debates, the arguments that keep you up at night. What if they aren't actually problems with the universe at all? What if they are just glitches in how we use language?
It is a radically different way to look at the world. And to understand how someone even gets to that point, we really need to set the stage. We kind of have to rewind a bit to the 19th century empiricists.
Yeah.
Thinkers like John Stuart Mill.
Okay, so pre-Wittgenstein.
Exactly. We need to look at the intellectual climate they created, because this was an era that was deeply, totally captivated by objective, empirical scientific knowledge. They were championing what is known as the hypothetico-deductive method.
Hold on, let's just pause right there, because hypothetico-deductive method is a massive term. If we are breaking this down for someone hearing it for the very first time, what does that actually look like in practice?
Fair enough, yeah. It basically means that all reliable explanations of the world have to follow a very strict scientific structure. You start with a broad general hypothesis, and then you deductively test it against observable reality.
Kind of like a detective.
Exactly like a detective.
Hmm.
You form a theory based on evidence. You test that theory in the real world. And if the physical evidence matches, you have reliable knowledge. If it doesn't,
just throw it out.
You throw it out. It's the core of the scientific method.
Got it. So it's about physical proof. No guessing, no gut feelings.
Precisely. And this mindset, it bleeds heavily into the early 20th century. It gets picked up by people like Bertrand Russell, who introduces this concept of logical atomism.
Wait, logical atomism? We're talking about breaking language down into literal atoms, like in physics?
Conceptually, yes.
Yeah.
Russell looked at the immense success of the scientific method, and he wanted to apply it to absolutely everything. All human knowledge, all human communication, all philosophy.
Wow.
He believed you could break language and logic down into their smallest, uncuttable pieces of meaning. They're atoms. It's a worldview that gets labeled as scientism. It's this strict, unyielding belief that this empirical scientific method is the one and only acceptable way to get reliable knowledge about anything. Period.
And that rigid, scientifically obsessed environment is the exact world our main character walks into. And what a character he is. I was reading the source notes about his teaching style, and it is, well, it's wild. If you were taking a class with Wittgenstein at Cambridge, you were not sitting in some massive, sleepy lecture hall taking notes while a professor droned on.
No, not at all.
According to Dr. Holmes, he would literally thin out his registration lists. He would systematically boot people out of his class until he had just a half dozen handpicked students.
Which is intimidating enough on its own.
Right. But it gets better. He wouldn't even teach in a classroom. He would have you come to his personal living quarters. Picture the scenario. You walk into his room, and he's sitting backward astride a hardback chair, his arms just resting on the top of the backrest.
Just staring.
Yeah. He is lost in deep, profound thought. He will utter a single, dense sentence and then absolute silence. He expects the seminar students to take it from there.
The pressure.
He would leave these agonizingly long pauses, just sitting there in the quiet, waiting for a specific student. The notes mention some poor guy named David. He's just waiting for David to finally speak up and break the tension.
You can almost feel the anxiety in that room just talking about it. But that intense, almost painful focus was entirely directed at one specific text he wrote early in his career, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus.
Or Tractatus.
Yes. Interestingly enough, Bertrand Russell himself wrote the introduction to it. And the big claim that kicks all of this off, the core theme that both Wittgenstein and Russell share, is that traditional philosophy, all those centuries of metaphysical debate, arises entirely from human ignorance and the misuse of language.
But how do you even begin to fix something as messy as human language? From what I'm seeing here, Bertrand Russell thought the answer was inventing an entirely new ideal language.
Yes, a perfect language.
A language where every single noun refers to exactly one fact. No ambiguity, no double meanings, just pure scientific precision.
He did. But Wittgenstein takes it a massive step further. He says the whole reason we are confused in the first place is that we completely misunderstand the basic logic of our own language. And here is where he makes a crucial, fundamental distinction. He says the world is the totality of facts, not of things.
Okay, I'm going to need you to unpack that one for me. What is the difference between a fact and a thing in his mind?
It is a vital distinction.
Yeah.
And it does take a second to wrap your head around. A fact, in his vocabulary, is the existence of a state of affairs. Things or objects are just the raw constituents. They are the building blocks of those states of affairs.
Okay.
Words name things, but proposition sentences with an actual logical structure assert facts. Let me give you an example. If I just walk up to you on the street and say the words brown and house, I haven't actually told you anything.
I would look at you like you were speaking nonsense.
Exactly. I'm just naming things.
Okay.
But if I use a proposition and say the house is brown, I am now asserting a fact. I am describing a state of affairs that you can go and physically verify.
Right. I can go look at the house.
The problem, according to Wittgenstein, is that we constantly confuse the two, and we use the exact same word to name entirely different things.
I found an illustration of this in Dr. Holmes' lecture that I think perfectly captures how messy this gets. He uses the phrase, green is green. Think about how confusing that is when you really break it down. The first green could be a man's name, William Green. The second green could be a property or an emotion. He is envious. He is green with envy. Or it could be a physical place.
And Dr. Holmes shares a great personal anecdote to drive that specific point home. Right after World War II, he was stationed at a military base just outside Cambridge. On his days off, he would wander around the university grounds. He remembers walking along the River Cam, noting these lush, incredibly green meadows and quadrangles, the university green.
So if we put all of that together, you could theoretically have a guy named William Green standing on the university green feeling green with envy.
Exactly.
It is the exact same sign, the physical sound green coming out of your mouth, acting as entirely different symbols.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you start to see how this linguistic ambiguity creates massive historical philosophical pileups. Take the mind-body problem.
Oh, yeah.
It is arguably one of the most famous debates in human history. How does the physical biological body interact with the immaterial ghostly mind?
That's something people still argue about today, especially when we talk about artificial intelligence or consciousness.
Absolutely. But Wittgenstein's framework suggests the problem only exists because of a glitch in our language. Think about it. We use the word mind as a noun. We use it the exact same way we use the word apple or table.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Because it's a noun, our grammar tricks us into assuming it must refer to a distinct physical, or in this case, immaterial entity.
So we treat it like a thing because our language tells us it's a thing.
Precisely. But if we analyze the logic of our language properly, the word mind shouldn't refer to a ghost in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
It simply refers to certain empirical, observable brain functions. The philosophical problem entirely vanishes when you clean up the syntax.
Looking through the notes here, there's a phrase that really caught my eye. Here's where it gets really interesting. It's called the picture theory of meaning. If I'm reading this right, is he actually suggesting that our thoughts are literal models of reality?
He is. He argues that our mental representations, the thoughts inside our heads, are literal, logical pictures of the world. They are mental models.
Mm-hmm.
And for those models to actually mean anything, the logical form of our language absolutely must match the logical form of the objective states of affairs in the real world.
But what happens if it doesn't match? What if I use language to talk about something that doesn't physically exist in the real world?
That leads us directly into his strict empiricist theory of meaning. And this traces its roots back to those earlier thinkers we mentioned, like David Hume and John Stuart Mill. The rule here is brutally simple. If a statement does not have an empirical, physical, observable referent, it is meaningless nonsense.
Wow.
It is completely empty. You might remember David Hume famously declaring that if a book doesn't contain mathematical reasoning or experimental reasoning about matters of fact, we should literally commit it to the flames. He believed it could contain nothing but sophistry and illusion.
Commit it to the flames. Burn the books of meaningless metaphysical twaddle. That is aggressive.
Very aggressive.
But that exact energy is what gets carried into the 1930s and 40s with a movement called logical positivism. People like A.J. Ayer championed this. They created something called the verifiability principle. In fact, the very first chapter of Ayer's famous book is literally titled The Elimination of Metaphysics.
They weren't hiding their goals.
Not at all. They were on an absolute crusade to wipe out anything that couldn't be proven in a lab.
Which culminates in what might be the most famous mic drop quote from Wittgenstein's early work. At the very end of the Tractatus, he writes, "What can be said at all can be said clearly. What we cannot talk about clearly, we must pass over in silence.
Pass over in silence.
Essentially, if you can't back it up with empirical facts, put up or shut up.
So what does this all mean for philosophy? I mean, if you are a philosopher reading this in the 1920s, you have to be sweating.
Absolutely.
If philosophy isn't allowed to assert truths about the universe anymore, because that is strictly the job of the natural sciences now, what is even left for the philosopher to do?
It is a massive demotion, or at the very least, a total job redescription. Under this strict framework, philosophy is no longer a body of doctrine. You shouldn't walk around talking about Hegel's philosophy as if it is a collection of facts about the universe.
Right.
Instead, philosophy becomes an activity. It acts as the ultimate logic of language switchboard.
I love that visual from the text, the philosopher as a 1920s telephone operator.
It perfectly describes the new role. When someone calls in with a confusing, tangled question about the universe, the philosopher doesn't actually answer the question themselves. They just analyze the syntax.
They clean up the lines.
Yes. They clean up the language, figure out what empirical data is actually being requested, and then they plug that call into the correct scientific department, physics, biology, psychology, to get the actual answer. Philosophy is reduced to just the critique of language.
But applying this strict scientific empiricism to absolutely everything creates some incredibly radical implications for how we live our daily lives. I want to ask you about causation, because the notes here say that Wittgenstein shatters the idea of cause and effect.
He does.
Wait, so if I drop an apple, he's saying gravity isn't forcing it to fall.
It is a really tough pill to swallow, because our whole modern conception of the world is founded on this illusion. We think the laws of nature are these ironclad rules forcing things to happen.
Because they happen every time.
But Wittgenstein, following right in David Hume's footsteps, points out that causal necessity doesn't actually exist in the physical world. The only true necessity is logical necessity. Like the fact that a triangle must have three sides, that is true by definition.
But the physical world doesn't work by definitions.
Exactly. The idea that one physical event must follow another is purely a psychological illusion.
Yeah.
It is just conditioning. We have seen the sun rise every single morning of our lives, so our expectations are deeply conditioned to believe it will rise tomorrow. But there is no logical compulsion making it happen. We just expect it to.
If losing causation is wild, the void of ethics is even heavier. The source material explains that in a world consisting solely of purely empirical scientific facts, values simply do not physically exist. You can't put a moral value under a microscope.
No, you can't.
Therefore, according to the early Wittgenstein, there are no ethical propositions. You cannot state a moral fact.
And this directly leads to what is known as the emotivist theory of ethics. Under this view, when you look at someone and say, "Thou shalt not steal," you aren't stating a fact about the universe. You are just venting an emotion.
You're just reacting.
You're essentially just making a disapproving noise about someone else's behavior. Ethics isn't about physical rewards or punishments in the observable world, so it cannot be put into logical, factual words.
And that profound silence extends to the ultimate human question, too. Death. For Wittgenstein, death is not an event in life. Why? Because we do not live to experience it. There is no empirical knowledge of death, because the very moment it arrives, the observer is gone.
Gone entirely.
Therefore, the problem of life, the search for its ultimate meaning, vanishes the exact moment life ends. No life, no problem.
Which sparked this incredibly strange, almost comical debate among the logical positivists themselves. You had Rudolf Carnap and Moritz Schlick arguing in the 1920s about whether the concept of immortality was empirically meaningless.
How do you even argue that empirically?
Well, Schlick said, yes, obviously it's meaningless. We can't observe an afterlife. But Carnap argued that if there is an afterlife, we will eventually have empirical data for it once we are actually there to observe it.
It is wonderfully absurd. In the text notes, this leads to the philosopher John Hick's concept of eschatological verification. It's this idea that religious language or beliefs might technically be verifiable, but only at the very end of time. It allows for the scenario where, on the last day, you could turn to someone and say, "Hey, I told you so. Here's the data."
It's a clever workaround. But again, for the early Wittgenstein, trying to solve the riddle of life by looking outside of space and time is entirely missing the point. If you can't speak about it in clear empirical propositions right now, you must pass over it in silence.
So he builds this bulletproof, totally rigid, scientifically rigorous system. He publishes the Tractatus in 1921. He looked around, dusts off his hands, and basically says, well, I've solved philosophy. My work here is done.
He really thought he was finished.
And he literally quits. In 1929, Wittgenstein just drops out of philosophy. He leaves Cambridge. He goes off to teach elementary school. He works as a gardener. He designs a house for his sister. He just walks away from the whole thing.
Completely abandons the field.
But then in the 1940s, he comes back and he writes a new book, Philosophical Investigations, published in 1945. And the goal of this new book is to completely dismantle and destroy everything he built in his early work.
This raises an important question, maybe the most important question of the whole era. What went wrong? Why did this dream of perfect, logical language collapse?
Why burn his own system to the ground?
It ultimately comes down to a fatal self-referential flaw. Think back to the verifiability principle. That was the rule that said a statement is only meaningful if it can be empirically accessed and verified. Well, critics, and eventually Wittgenstein himself, realized something absolutely devastating. The verifiability principle itself cannot be empirically verified.
Oh, wow. So you can't put the rule itself under a microscope.
Precisely. You cannot physically observe the verifiability principle. So by its own strict, uncompromising rules, the foundational rule of logical positivism is completely meaningless. It imploded under its own weight.
It is the ultimate philosophical cell phone. Wittgenstein realizes that his picture theory of meaning has no clear meaning. He looks back at Russell's dream of an ideal, perfectly logical language and realizes it is way too artificial. And I love the analogy he uses to explain this.
The parade ground.
Yes. He says that symbolic logic and strict scientific language are like parade ground foot drill for soldiers. Think about a military parade. It's sharp, it's disciplined, every single angle is perfectly measured. It is fantastic for teaching fundamental discipline. But you would never use that rigid, upright marching style on an actual muddy, chaotic battlefield. You'd be wiped out immediately.
And human communication is the battlefield.
Huh?
It is messy, it is entirely context dependent, and it is full of what he starts calling language games. This is the massive paradigm shift of his later work. By the 1940s, Wittgenstein completely abandoned scientism. He realizes that trying to source all meaningful human discourse into the narrow, rigid box of empirical science is a huge mistake.
So what does a language game actually look like in everyday life?
Think about how we use words differently depending on the context. Language isn't just for stating scientific facts. It's for joking. It's for praying. It's for cursing when you stub your toe. It's for creating art.
Right. The context changes everything.
The meaning of a word doesn't come from pointing to a physical object in the world. Its meaning comes from how it is used within a specific game. If you are telling a joke, the rules of the language game are different than if you were testifying in a courtroom. By acknowledging this, he opens the door right back up to aesthetics, to ethics, and to the beauty of ordinary everyday language.
This has been a wild ride to unpack. To bring this all together for you, we started in a strict, mathematically rigid universe where only scientific facts mattered and any talk of ethics or meaning was literally thrown into the fire. And we end up realizing that human communication is a beautifully messy battlefield of language games.
It's quite the journey.
I think there's a huge practical takeaway here. The next time you find yourself stuck in a frustrating disagreement, maybe at work or arguing with a friend, it might be worth channeling a little bit of that early Wittgenstein switchboard operator. Take a step back and ask, are we actually arguing about facts, or are we just using the same sign, the same physical word, to represent two completely different symbols? Are you talking about William Green while they're talking about the Cambridge Quadrangle?
That is a highly practical way to apply his logic of language to modern life. But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over, drawing entirely on a specific, striking detail from his writings on death. Wittgenstein famously claimed that our life has no end, just as our visual field has no limits.
Oh, that's interesting.
I want you to think about your vision right now. You can't actually see the edges of your sight. The world just is. If we stop treating the limits of our lives and the limits of our language as a desperate riddle to be solved, and instead view them simply as the natural, unseeable edges of our current visual field, how might that change the way we approach our daily anxieties?
Wow.
If the problem of life vanishes the moment life does, maybe the point isn't to agonizingly solve the puzzle. Maybe the point is simply to look closely and clearly at whatever is right in front of us.
That is a phenomenal thought to end on. Thank you so much for exploring this incredibly complex, shifting terrain with us today. Keep questioning the words you use, and we will see you on the next deep dive.